6 o'clock news.
The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Tuesday, March 11th. I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful.
And I'm your host, Christian Knutson. In tonight's news, student protesters at UW-Madison stage a walkout in solidarity with Mahmoud Khalil.
An incumbent alder says he's committed to serving the most vulnerable residents in his district.
And in the second half, the milkweed explains how Wisconsin became known as the Dairy State, Stuff Your Face sits down with a local food industry veteran, and Wildlife Weekly shares some springtime predictions.
All these stories and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to BBC for reports from around the world.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. Ukraine says an American proposal for an immediate 30-day ceasefire in the war with Russia includes a truce in the air, at sea and along the entire front line as US officials prepare to present the deal to Moscow. After 8 hours of talks in Saudi Arabia, Ukraine backed the proposal, with President Zelensky describing it as a positive step. James Waterhouse is in Kyiv.
For Ukraine, there is a political sigh of relief. This statement means that America's and Ukraine's relationship is seemingly patched up. For Ukraine, it was all about restoring a constructive dialogue. It was about having American aid and intelligence sharing restored, and that seems to be the case. This proposed ceasefire would, in the words of Marco Rubio, be along the entire front line. It would freeze the contact line before further negotiations can take place.
Meanwhile, the United States has lifted its suspension of military and intelligence support for Ukraine after those talks in Jeddah. It was paused last week following a dramatic showdown between Donald Trump and President Zelensky at the White House. The two sides say they will now work to finalize the agreement as soon as possible. US stock markets have had a second turbulent day after Donald Trump announced he was doubling the tariffs for imports of Canadian steel and aluminium before reversing his decision a few hours later. Mr. Trump changed course after the Canadian province of Ontario agreed to roll back its threat to significantly increase the cost of electricity it supplies to American homes. Here's our North America business correspondent, Erin Delmore.
It's a remarkable turnaround after President Trump earlier threatened to increase tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum by an additional 25%, bringing the total import tax to 50%. President Trump has now walked that back, but he reiterated his desire to absorb Canada into the U.S. as its 51st state. And a scheduled 25% tariff on steel and aluminum is still going into effect tomorrow. Canada is America's biggest supplier of both.
A plane carrying the former Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte has left Manila for the International Criminal Court in The Hague, where he'll face trial. Prosecutors allege that during his presidency, Mr. Duterte had thousands of drug dealers, users and others killed without trial. John Sifton from Human Rights Watch welcomed Manila's decision to hand Mr. Duterte over to the ICC.
If you had told many Filipinos, if you had told us at Human Rights Watch that one day President Duterte would be on an airplane flying to The Hague, we would have been very surprised given the level of impunity that he enjoyed. But it's a historic day, and I think Filipino victims and survivors and surviving family members of victims should have a lot to celebrate today.
BBC News. Security forces in Pakistan have rescued more than 100 people who were taken hostage in an attack on a passenger train. Insurgents are locked in a battle with troops in a mountainous area of Balochistan province. It's unclear how many hostages are still being held. The Jaffa Express was carrying more than 400 people when it was attacked. The Portuguese government has collapsed, having lost a confidence vote in Parliament. The motion was tabled by the minority coalition government itself. The Prime Minister, Luís Montenegro, is embroiled in controversy over a potential conflict of interest. It means the country now faces a third election in barely 3 years. An appeals court in France has ruled the French state must compensate people in two Caribbean territories who can demonstrate they've been affected by anxiety over exposure to a dangerous pesticide. The Court of Appeal highlighted state failures to protect people in Martinique and Guadeloupe from chlordecone, used in banana plantations until it was banned 30 years ago. The pesticide has been linked to cases of prostate cancer, infertility and child mental health issues. West Africa's regional bloc, ECOWAS, is set to activate a standby force to tackle terrorism and transnational crimes. Defence chiefs meeting in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, say the force will be jointly funded by member states. Chris Awoko reports.
This will be the first standby force by the regional bloc to fight insurgency and terror threats. ECOWAS is grappling with a mixture of political instability and security challenges, including jihadist insurgency, cross-border crimes and piracy. The force will be in the mould of the former military arm of the bloc, known as ECOMOG, which was formed in 1990 to regularly intervene in conflicts within the region. With the three Sahel nations now outside the bloc, ECOWAS must confront the fight against terror without their collective military support.
BBC News.
This is Christian Knutson and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call, a Democrat, waded into the contentious race for state Supreme Court yesterday, speaking out against conservative candidate Brad Schimmel. As a Republican, Schimmel previously served as the state's attorney general, and Call blasted his record on testing rape kits. While Schimmel held the position, the State Department of Justice took more than 2 years to begin testing the approximately 4,000 kits sitting in police departments and hospitals across the state. The state received a $4 million federal grant in 2015 to begin testing kits, but that work didn't begin until 2017. Schimmel declared that his administration completed the testing in 2018, but Call says Schimmel left the state hundreds of kits to test, work that wasn't completed until November 2019. Call's remarks are the latest in this spring's intense battle for Wisconsin Supreme Court. The race is expected to take the top spot as the most expensive court election in U.S. history.
Democrat Rebecca Cook announced plans this morning to challenge Republican U.S. Representative Derek Van Orden once again. This announcement kicks off the 2026 race for what the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel dubs, quote, the tightest battleground district in Wisconsin, unquote. Cook lost to Van Orden by less than 3 points in the last election cycle. That narrow margin in the 2024 election set Cook apart as a competitive Democratic candidate, as she outperformed both Kamala Harris and U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin in raw votes and percentage points. At this time, it is unclear whether other Democrats will join the race, but Cook has the support of leading Democrats like U.S. Representative Mark Bocan.
Two women have died from respiratory illness at the Tichita Correctional Institution in Fond du Lac, and their families are seeking answers as the prison remains tight-lipped about the cause of death, reports Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch. Shawnee Reed and Brittany Dosher were hospitalized on February 22nd. Reed died the next day, and Dosher remained on life support for 2 weeks before passing away last Thursday. Both women mentioned having health issues to family members over the phone at least a month before their hospitalization. The two women's deaths were not publicly announced by the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. 6 days after the initial hospitalizations, corrections officers locked down Tichita, restricting inmate movement due to, quote, an increase in respiratory illness, unquote, according to an internal memo. That lockdown was lifted on Thursday. The lack of information and transparency has raised many questions for Tichita inmates and their families. Due to the recent outbreak of respiratory illness, Tichita has temporarily lifted the $7.50 copay for medical visits, which is among the highest in the nation. The steep cost of medical care within Wisconsin prisons is a significant barrier for incarcerated people.
With 151 wildfires recorded and 400 acres of land burned since the start of this year, Wisconsin has seen an unusually early start to this year's wildfire season. Many of these fires were caused by burning of debris, but for most fires, the cause is unknown due to a lack of physical evidence, reports Wisconsin Examiner. Conditions are ripe for wildfires this year due to the lack of late winter snowfall in the state. More than 3 million Wisconsin residents live in areas currently experiencing drought conditions. Climate scientists say this year's trend will likely continue thanks to high levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and persistent dry conditions.
One of the oldest gay bars in the country, This Is It in Milwaukee, closed its doors on Sunday after 56 years of service, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. According to the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project, people came to This Is It to celebrate numerous historic victories, including the Non-Discrimination Ordinance of 1980, the Gay Rights Law of 1982, the first annual Pride March and Rally in 1989, Tammy Baldwin's election to the U.S. House in 1998, and the advent of marriage equality in 2014 and 2015. Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project Chair Mikhail Takic says he's concerned by the timing of the bar's closing, following President Donald Trump's executive order for the federal government to identify people by their sex assigned at birth. Takic adds that This Is It's closing is likely just the beginning of more closures to come at a time when the LGBTQ gathering spaces are more needed.
Madison's transportation director indicated that the city may need to rethink its approach to the proposed north-south bus rapid transit line route in light of threats to federal funding, reports Isthmus. In May of last year, the Federal Transit Administration recommended that the city receive $118 million to cover the costs for this route expansion. That federal funding seems unlikely to be approved under the Trump administration, which opposes green energy projects like the city's electric buses. City officials have indicated that they are considering alternative strategies if this funding falls through, including possibly scaling back its plans for the north-south line.
UW-Madison researchers are being hit with travel and funding restrictions brought about by the Trump administration, reports the Capital Times. Rick Lindroth, an ecology professor at UW-Madison, was 4 days out from embarking on a Fulbright research project in Argentina when his award was rescinded by the federal government. Although he did not receive additional explanation, Lindroth believes his project was defunded because the term climate change was in its title. The Trump administration's attacks on science threatens the United States' reputation internationally. Scientific research at U.S. institutions has historically sought to help other nations develop in medicine, astronomy, and other academic fields. Lindroth says that, quote, "What's being threatened, proposed, and paused by the Trump administration is extraordinary and will be exceedingly damaging," unquote.
The city of Madison announced today that its Building Energy Savings Program has entered its second year. The program requires large commercial buildings to evaluate their energy consumption annually and to complete a building tune-up every 4 years. Mayor Sacha Rhodes Conway touted this program in a statement, saying it plays a vital role in reducing energy waste and improving efficiency across Madison. The city is hosting a series of virtual training sessions over the next few months to help building owners navigate the reporting process. And those were tonight's headlines. Now on to the rest of today's top stories.
A crowd of students at UW-Madison joined a walkout this morning in support of Mahmoud Khalil, a key figure in last spring's pro-Palestine protests at Columbia University in New York City. Khalil was arrested Saturday by ICE agents, sparking fears for student activists here in Madison. WRT reporter Crowena Kermines was at today's demonstration.
Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
Roughly 100 students gathered at the UW-Madison Library Mall this afternoon to protest the recent arrest of Mahmoud Khalil. Khalil was a key spokesperson in last spring's pro-Palestine protests on the Columbia University campus. Khalil was arrested by ICE agents on Saturday and is currently being held at an ICE detention center in Louisiana. He hasn't been charged with any crime, and the reason for the arrest of a lawful permanent resident is unclear.
The abduction of Mahmoud Khalil was illegal by U.S. law. But that doesn't matter. That literally doesn't matter because the laws are words on a piece of paper if we don't fight for them.
Speakers at today's protest included Dalia Saba, a prominent member of the Students for Justice in Palestine organization. I also had the opportunity to speak with Kareem, a recent UW-Madison graduate and fellow SJP member, who shed further light on the motivations behind the protest.
Really, this protest is it's an act of solidarity with Palestinians, with Mahmoud Khalil, but it's also sending a message to the university that we're not going to let them silence us and or prevent us from exercising our basic constitutional rights, including freedom of speech, freedom of assembly.
Yesterday, UW-Madison, along with 60 other universities nationwide, received a letter from the Department of Education warning of, quote, potential enforcement action, unquote, if they do not sufficiently combat anti-Semitism on campus. The Trump administration demands that these universities make efforts to quell pro-Palestine movements among their students, or potentially see their federal funding cut.
We have seen from Columbia that there is no amount of brutality that a university can inflict upon its students that is enough for the Trump administration. Columbia has consistently attacked, punished, and stripped away the rights of the Palestinian students on their campus and their allies, and still they had their funding cut. So from here, UW-Madison has a very easy choice. Does UW-Madison want to be the type of school that, in the face of fascism, collaborates with the fascists and probably still gets their funding cut? No. Or will it stand up for the rights of its students? No. I'm going to be honest, I'm not optimistic about UW-Madison's track record.
In a statement released today, UW-Madison spokesperson John Lucas asserted that the university continues to cooperate with any federal investigations and is committed to, quote, supporting its Jewish badgers, free expression, and helping all students feel a sense of belonging, unquote. Earlier today, 14 members of the U.S. House penned a letter calling for Khalil's release. They echoed the same sentiment as the UW-Madison protesters today, characterizing his detention an, quote, attempt to criminalize political protest, unquote, and a, quote, direct assault on freedom of speech, unquote.
An immigrant fighter under attack? What do I do?
Stand up, fight back!
What do I do?
Stand up, fight back!
What do I do?
Stand up, fight back!
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Croenna Cremines.
It's 6:17 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Incumbent Alder Tague Evers has represented the West Side on Madison City Council since 2019. He is seeking another term this spring and faces one opponent in Robert Luther, a U.S. Navy veteran and retired City of Madison firefighter. Sitting down with WORT news producer Faye Parks, Evers outlined his all-of-the-above approach to Madison's affordable housing crisis.
Hi, my name is Tague Evers, and I currently serve as District 13 Alder. I was first elected in 2019, and I'm running for my fourth term on City Council. I moved to Madison for grad school in 1988 and stayed. I started promoting concerts in the early 90s, and my company, True Endeavors, now does shows all over the Midwest. It's been my pleasure to build community and bring people together around music. And when I ran for office in 2019, I did so under the belief that I had the capacity to bring people together around the ideas that would make Madison a better city for all. I've lived in District 13 since 2006. I built strong relationships with the residents of this district and would be honored to continue serving them for a fourth term.
Now, as you mentioned, you've served on the council since 2019. What has you coming back for another term?
The answer is there's a lot more work to be done. Since holding office, I've focused on elevating the needs of District 13's most vulnerable residents. There's a lot of diversity in District 13. We have, you know, million-dollar homes in Vilas and in Dungeon Monroe, but we also have some of the city's most vulnerable residents. I serve on the board of directors of the Bayview Foundation, and I'm very excited with what we've accomplished with the recently completed redevelopment project with those brightly colored buildings and the state-of-the-art energy-efficient community center that everyone should visit. With the completion, though, of Bayview's project, my attention has now shifted to the CDA apartments also on the Triangle. And that's going to be a 10-year multi-phase project, and we're set to break ground this spring. I played a leadership role in re-energized focus on Regent Street. Now, there's now a 40-member group of stakeholders representing local businesses, residents, the nearby hospitals, the UW, city staff, and elected officials as we together envision the possibilities of what the street could become. With another 100,000-plus residents expected to move to Madison by the year 2050, it would be irresponsible not to plan for the future. I'm running again to continue the work I started when I was first elected.
Now, you've outlined a few projects that are still ongoing. I'm curious, do you have one specific achievement that you drove forward in your latest term that you would like to shout out?
I mentioned Regent Street, part of that renewed focus, and that dovetailed with the recent update to the city's comprehensive plan. Working with staff and residents to review the height limits for parcels along Regent Street, we were able to come to an agreement, increasing the height limit for many of the parcels from 4 stories to 6 stories. Residents in Vilas and in Greenbush, who had in the past vocally opposed infill along connector streets like Regent and Monroe, together we were successful. I was successful, I suppose it's fair to say, in helping residents see the need for increased density and that approving more housing along transit routes like Regent made sense. And this kind of collaboration paid off with the Jensen Auto Body site, where the nonprofit developer, the Wisconsin Housing Preservation Corporation, received approval from Plan Commission to build a 5-story, 50-unit project with 75% of the units being allocated to workforce housing. And this workforce housing component is really essential. People who work in Madison, our teachers, our nurses, our cops and firefighters, should be able to live in the city where they work.
So I'd like to speak more on housing generally, as it's perhaps the most complex and sprawling issue the city faces. It impacts everyone from families trying to find an affordable home to college students trying to find affordable off-campus housing. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job, paying about $28 per hour or about $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated, it's hard to know where to start. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
The rising cost of housing is directly related to our severe housing shortage. It's that shortage, due to the law of supply and demand, results in rising or increased housing values. And the impacts are disparate. Our low vacancy rates, among the lowest in the nation, result in some of the highest annual increases in monthly rents. But if you own your own home and were able to lock in, say, a 3% 30-year mortgage, the higher housing values actually add to your net worth. That disparity there creates tension. Existing homeowners push back on density and infill, while others are pushing for more housing in the hopes that we can bend the curve downward. And the downstream effects of our housing shortage, of our affordability crisis, so to speak, it has a deleterious impact, particularly on our more vulnerable residents across the city. You can imagine families that are forced to double up or move frequently to, you know, get out from under the sort of Damocles that an impending eviction may bring. Nonetheless, people are moving to the city in great numbers, and it's simply not possible to build a moat around the city and tell folks not to come. They're coming, and we need to plan for it. It's irresponsible not to. We've made significant gains since I was first elected in 2019. That's the same year Satya became mayor. We've more than tripled the Affordable Housing Fund. We've added flexibility to how the fund is used. We've greatly expanded our land banking program, which is a program that takes parcels out of the speculative real estate market, essentially freezing them at the current value. We can hold on to those parcels. We can bank them, so to speak, until we figure out what we want to do with them and often create affordable housing in that location. We've been more aggressive in the use of TIF or tax incremental financing. We've modified our zoning ordinance to reduce barriers, to incentivize development along our transit routes, to provide for a mix of housing types, including ADUs. But in answer to your question, there's no magic bullet. We need to take an all-of-the-above approach to building more housing at all price levels and doing what we can to expand our ability to subsidize housing at levels that are affordable for residents who particularly are on the lower side of the income scale.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit outside of raising property taxes again?
Well, of course, we have to continue to look for efficiencies. It's just cold, hard facts that we don't have a lot of fat trim. The mayor and the common council agreed to a 5-year plan that offers guidance as to how we're going to balance the budget moving forward. I sit on the finance committee. It's clear that we have to keep a sharp eye on expenses. And while we do have a sizable fund balance, or what's called the rainy day fund, that's one-time money that on an annual basis, it's not sustaining for us to use for the operating budget. I get it that folks are frustrated by property taxes. Mine have increased as well. But this is a problem that's also connected to our severe housing shortage and the raw deal that we're getting from the state. The levy limit formula changed by Scott Walker no longer accounts for inflation, and the shared revenue formula actually punishes Madison to the point where we only get 18 cents on the dollar back from all the income and sales taxes that you and I pay to the state. We're getting a raw deal. I'm glad that the mayor's announced that we're about to sign a contract with a lobbying firm that will go to bat and work on our behalf to fight for a better deal with the state. In the meantime, we're going to have to continue to be vigilant, do what we can to address these concerns, and hope again for a better deal with the state.
I want to ask how you think about your role on the council. Alders have two priorities to their constituents in their districts and to the city of Madison. Sometimes those priorities conflict. How would you handle an issue that drives forward the city's goals but is unpopular among your constituents?
Let me say this. When there's a controversial issue, there's generally not a consensus on how to proceed, meaning there's no uniform District 13 opinion or no uniform, say, neighborhood opinion. There's not a single point of view. But there are times when there's a dominant opinion within a neighborhood about a given topic that may run counter to what I think is right, particularly in terms of what I think is best for the district as a whole and what may be best for the city. But I was elected to represent the interests of all residents in District 13 and to weigh in on what's best for the city. And for that matter, I was also elected to represent the interests of those who live in the city now, while also taking into account the needs and the interests of those who will live in the city, say, some 50 years hence. With respect to controversial topics, I think it's important to consider that the loudest voices, those who always have a seat at the table, while they are indeed important, their voices need to be balanced with the voices of those who, various reasons, are not able to show up. I try to remind my constituents that I'm there to listen. It's important to listen to make sure all voices are heard. It's definitive of participatory democracy. But voice does not mean veto. I try to make it clear to my constituents I will always listen. We will not always agree, but I will always, always listen.
Incumbent Alder Tag Evers will be on the April 1st ballot. He faces one challenger in Robert Luther. You can learn more about Alder Evers on his website, tagevers.com.
You're listening to local news by local people here on WORT.
Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. The Milkweed delves into Wisconsin's dairy history.
Stuff Your Face dines at a locally focused snack bar.
And Wildlife Weekly tries to keep up with a busy prelude to spring.
But now we'll take a quick break and check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash.
We'll be right back.
YWCA Madison invites you to join them to celebrate the 22nd annual Circle fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. YWCA Madison is eager to gather with their community of supporters to share stories that speak to who they are and demonstrate their values of humanity, community, growth, and restoration, which are at the heart of how they move as an organization. Attending the Circle fundraiser impacts the lives of thousands of women, children, and families who are served each year through YWCA's transformational programs in housing and shelter, employment and transportation, restorative justice, and learning and movement building. More information about the Circle fundraiser and other YWCA programs and resources can be found at ywcamadison.org. That's the 22nd annual Circle fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center. Keeping you informed of community events and resources, this is WORT 89.9 FM and WORTFM.org.
BBC News with Moira Alderson. Ukraine says an American proposal for an immediate 30-day ceasefire in the war with Russia includes a truce in the air, at sea, and along the entire front line, as US officials prepare to present the deal to Moscow. After 8 hours of talks in Saudi Arabia, Ukraine backed the proposal, with President Zelensky describing it as a positive step. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said the ball was now in Russia's court. President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is due to travel to Moscow in the coming days. US stock markets have had a second turbulent day after Donald Trump announced he was doubling the tariffs for imports of Canadian steel and aluminium before reversing his decision a few hours later. Mr. Trump changed course after the Canadian province of Ontario agreed to roll back its threat to significantly increase the cost of electricity it supplies to American homes. The U.S. Department of Education says it's cutting its staff by almost 50% as the Trump administration presses ahead with plans to reduce the federal workforce. Those affected will be placed on administrative leave from the 21st of March. Security forces in Pakistan have rescued more than 100 people who were taken hostage in an attack on a passenger train. Insurgents are locked in a battle with troops in a mountainous area of Balochistan province. It's unclear how many hostages are still being held. An appeals court in France has ruled that the French state must compensate people in two Caribbean territories who can demonstrate they've been affected by anxiety over exposure to a dangerous pesticide. The Court of Appeal highlighted state failures to protect people in Martinique and Guadeloupe from chlordecone. The Portuguese government's collapsed, having lost a confidence vote in Parliament. The Prime Minister is embroiled in controversy over a potential conflict of interest. BBC News.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knutson. Thanks for joining us. If Wisconsin is known for anything, it's fields of cows and many types of excellent cheese. Pete Hardin tells host Bert Zipper how Wisconsin became and earned the moniker of America's Dairyland in this archival edition of The Milkweed.
Welcome to The Milkweed on WORT. I'm Bert Zipper, and we're talking with Pete Hardin, who for 46 years has been publisher and editor of the monthly newspaper, The Milkweed, dairy farming's best information and insights, with their motto, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee on the masthead. Pete is a descendant of a vigorous dairy farming community in northern New Jersey. And today's topic is Wisconsin's dairy industry. Take it away.
Thank you, Bert. Right up front, let me say that in my opinion, the development and evolution of the Wisconsin dairy industry is the greatest example of economic development activity in the history of the United States.
Wow, wow.
Going back to the immediately post-Civil War era, Wisconsin's leaders realized they had a heck of a problem for the following reasons, economic challenge. Number one, the wheat belt, the intense production of wheat had depleted the soil's natural fertility that resulted from thousands of years of Mother Nature boosting soil organic matter. Number two, the wheat industry was challenged by a serious pest, the cinch bug, so that wheat yields were not only being pulled down by lack of soil fertility, but also by pests. So what came next? And also, we had in the southern third of Wisconsin or so, a lot of virgin timber had been harvested. So we had much of the state that had been settled was featured depleted soils and a bunch of stumps.
After being stolen from the Native Nations.
Yes, that's your insight, sir. So what to do? We had, you know, cities, towns, rail lines, population, but our economy, what the basis for the development of the economy had passed. So visionaries, led in great part by former Governor William Dempster Horde, perceived that dairy would be a solution to creating a sustainable Wisconsin economy, given our soils, our moisture, our climate, and the livestock skills of many of the northern Europeans who had settled here. So, dairy it was. We started humbly, and along the way, it was necessary to produce products that were storable, such as cheese and butter. There wasn't a lot of demand for fluid milk, except in the immediate areas right around the major population areas. So dairy it was, and you got to give a lot of credit to research at the University of Wisconsin for helping convert the dairy industry in the starting after the Civil War from a cottage industry to a science-based industry.
Yeah, what were some of those things?
Number one, development of the silo. Farmers were able, once the upright silo was built, farmers were better able to store their crops for winter feeding. Previously, dairy had been basically pasture-based with enough hay put up to sustain the animals through the winter, with maybe some sugar beets thrown in for energy. But the upright silo gave the farmers a year-round productive capacity as opposed to a seasonal grass-based thing.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, take the development of the butterfat test by Stephen Babcock at the University of Wisconsin. Since virtually all milk was priced based on strictly, the farmers paid strictly for the cream portion, getting a fair test for the farmer, which evolved in the early 1900s, that was critical for equitable valuing of the raw product, fair to the buyer, fair to the seller, particularly fair to the seller, given previous practices.
Exactly.
And then, it just, the industry just has burgeoned today to a point where, you know, we're talking from post-Civil War era, 6 to 8 generations later, this industry is one of Wisconsin's biggest industries, probably $45 to $50 billion in economic activity, tens of thousands of jobs. It's the big show in rural Wisconsin today.
And there's a democratic society component to it when you consider all the farmers, all the cheesemakers, all of the activity across rural Wisconsin historically.
Correct. And I think also, particularly in the early days, there were ancillary industries that developed, such as leather and also sausage industry. Now, we don't make as many shoes as we used to, but we still got a lot of Wisconsin based firms making processed meat products, which goes back in part, they had to have something to do with the spent dairy cow, but also the German heritage of many of the settlers here.
And Madison's east side, like a lot of communities across the state, were full of industries that were creating equipment for those farmers.
Exactly. The dairy industry uses just myriad inputs. There's a firm up in Marshfield, Nelson Jameson, which has a catalog of over 20,000 items for dairy processing plants and dairy farms, such as everything from cheese starter to the laboratory testing hardware, software, and chemicals. So there's a tremendous, dairy continues to be a tremendous source of Wisconsin's economy.
And talk a little bit about, I know back in the late 1920s, early 30s, there were something like 2,400 cheese factories in the state of Wisconsin. Talk a little bit about the cheese factories.
Well, we've seen a tremendous evolution from a cheese factory on many rural crossroad corners in Wisconsin. I think we're down to, a little over 200 in the state. And we obviously have, there are fewer cheese plants, but they are on average, larger. But there's still some small cheese plants around. And one of the interesting evolutions we've seen in the history of our cheese making is going from a reliance on basics like cheddar, Colby, Munster, to more specialized products. The evolution of specialty cheeses of all, be it Hispanic cheeses, low salt, low fat, just specialty cheese evolution is important, with particular emphasis on quality. For the average cheese plant, there's not much net profit making simply commodity cheese like cheddar or mozzarella. It's the upscale marketing of upscale products. And I think probably the greatest example here would be Bel Gioioso cheese up in the northeastern part of the state, with their tremendous array of Italian varieties of many flavors. Mr. and Mrs. Arricchio, who are the owners of Bel Gioioso, came over in the late 70s making provolone in a tiny little cheese plant. Today they've got 8 cheese plants in Wisconsin, 2 in New York. Virtually every major supermarket in the country has Bel Gioioso products. They treat their farmers well. They treat their employees well. It's a tremendous success story based on production and marketing of quality branded cheeses.
Thanks, Pete. If you want to learn more, go to themilkweed.com. I'm Bert Zipperer. We'll see you next week.
It's now 6:42 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. This week on Stuff Your Face, feature contributor Emily Tucker sits down with Lacey Rood. A veteran of the Madison food industry, Rood highlights local food producers at her snack bar-style cafe inside the Burr Oak on the city's east side.
Hello, listeners. Thanks for tuning in to Stuff Your Face. I'm sitting down today with Lacey Rood, who is the owner of Lacey's Cafe on Winnebago Street in the Burr Oak. Lacey, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
So Lacey, can you give us a rundown of how Lacey's Cafe started and how it's going?
Yeah, definitely. So last summer, I was just kind of having a casual conversation with Topher Christensen here at the Burr Oak, and there was this beautiful space in the front that was formerly occupied by a Han, wasn't being used for some months, and I was kind of like, hey, what are you doing with that space up there? And he's like, I'm not sure. Do you have any ideas? And I was like, yeah, I have like 5 ideas. So we just kind of got into a conversation very casually, randomly, and it just kind of happened.
Tell us what the concept is here with Lacey's Cafe.
So the cafe, operates as, I would call it like a snack bar style cafe. I mean, there's some hearty items and then some very like low key, more like snacky things. But the idea is to combine as many Wisconsin made products, support as many Wisconsin vendors as we can here, and have kind of all of it in one place.
We love that on Stuff Your Face to talk about how different food producers and food people in Madison and around this area connect with each other. So that's such a great concept. You have a lot of different Madison and local products that you feature here from day to day. So what's your favorite thing to stuff your face with that you offer right now?
Ooh, I would definitely say my favorite thing right now is a brand new breakfast sandwich that just rolled out this week, actually, called the Lucky Local Breakfast Sandwich. It is bagel or biscuit, and then egg, a cheese option, microgreens. There's options to add kimchi, truffle oil, avocado, meat, all kinds of things.
Lacey, I was just craving a biscuit breakfast sandwich last night, so you are speaking my language. And I know you said you have microgreens on that sandwich and you use supercharged greens. Is that correct?
Of course. Spicy microgreens for the win.
Fantastic. Yep. Jamal was on the show several months ago, so that's great. And people can visit your website to see different menu offerings you have. Is that right?
Yes. Right now, you can find a link to the menu and updates, you know, offerings on the Burr Oak Music Venue website. I also offer any of the items that are carried here to serve in-house to go. So there's a lot of prepackaged items you can store in your fridge, freezer, whatever, you know, for later use, almost like, you know, picking it up at the grocery store, and make sure to have lots of, you know, vegan and also gluten-free options. And many producers who are from the west side of Madison or otherwise, you know, getting us more availability of those items.
Okay, great. So Lacey, you're quite the entrepreneur from what I can tell. You've had your own kombucha business over the years. So what is the future of Lacey's Cafe?
Yeah, you know, I think if it wasn't for Rude Brew Kombucha and, you know, running that for the last like 10 years, I feel like, you know, I wouldn't have all these wonderful connections and friends in the food industry that I have. I mean, that's really blossomed and you know, caused this cafe to be what it is. And I foresee, you know, a lot of good things coming ahead. We're gaining a lot of traction with the cafe, adding new menu items regularly, running specials. And we're actually, I'm about to be launching some menu items available at select shows, evenings and weekends at the Burr Oak here. And then also we'll be expanding that into the Atwood Music Hall when it opens June 13th of this year.
Oh, how Woo-hoo. Exciting. Lovely. Yes. And thank you for sharing.
You bet.
And am I right that you used to make your Rude Brew kombucha in the basement here of the Burr Oak?
I did. And that's actually what brought me to this building in the first place, was renting out the lower level here to use as my fermentary.
Very cool. Well, we will continue to keep our eyes on what you're up to. Everyone should definitely check out Lacey's Cafe inside the Burr Oak Music Venue on Winnebago Street. And Lacey, thanks so much for joining me after your busy morning of cafe service.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a treat for sure.
You're listening to WORT. Spring has sprung, the busiest time of year for local wildlife and their rehabilitators at the Dane County Humane Society. Jackie Sandberg shares some updates and prediction in this edition of Wildlife Weekly.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I want to talk about the spring season. Spring is here, and spring is here meaning we got to talk about spring. It's our wildlife busy time of year, and it gets really scary as we get into this mid-March into mid-May period, and then boom, we are full of birds everywhere. So not just birds, mammals too. And believe it or not, just the other day we got our first call about baby pinky squirrels being born here in Madison. So we know it's happening. Typically, our first admitted baby of the year is actually a great horned owl. We have not yet admitted our first baby great horned owl yet, but it could be any day, any moment. But the fact that we got a call about pinky neonate baby squirrels, and that means that they're in their first day of life, means that the reproduction, you know, that whole process that has happened over winter, it is now finally coming to fruition for a lot of those small mammal species. So the drays up in people's yards, in their the trees, the really beautiful paper nests that are there, or in people's houses, are where people might be finding our baby squirrels being born, typically about 4 to 6 kits in a litter. So be on the lookout. I would say that the most important tips that we like to pass along in the spring period is that knowing that our babies are being born right now, be aware of what's on the ground around you, especially if you have pets that you put out in your yard, if there's a fenced-in yard, or even if you're taking them on a walk. A lot of times our pets, especially dogs, will sniff out and be able to find some kind of small critter and be very interested in it. So squirrels typically will fall from their nest down to the ground, maybe at the base of a tree. So that is something we see very often, and that's a pretty long tumble for a baby squirrel to take. And if they hit the ground really hard, we often see things like bloody noses, bruising on the body, and then they become hypothermic because it's too cold for them. If you imagine that they are pink and naked and helpless, their eyes are closed, their ears are closed, they are so newborn that they don't have the ability to thermoregulate their body temperature. So if those little guys are to fall from one of those paper nests up above, and let's say it's 30 feet down, that's really significant for such a tiny body to take that kind of impact trauma. And then the cold temperatures around us is not the same as mom cuddling up with her babies to keep them warm with her fat, her fur, her body heat, everything like that, which she would do in the nest. So these little guys are definitely susceptible to being outdoors in the outdoor temperature, even right now in the 50s, 60 degree temperatures. So we have to worry about that. And the longer they stay out, then the more at risk to dying from hypothermia they have. So if you do find a little baby pinky squirrel, let's say at the base of a tree, it doesn't mean that mom isn't around. It might mean that she's off, you know, gathering food, or she's feeding at the moment and one of the babies accidentally fell out of the paper nest because they're not that sturdy all the time. So we recommend checking our website for information about reuniting and renesting tree squirrels, www.giveshelter.org. But also knowing that heat support can be very helpful. A lot of times, just like a warm rice sack that you put in the microwave, and that rice sack can then hold the temperature a little bit better for the baby. You don't want it to be too hot though, because you can scald or burn the skin, especially when they don't have that extra fur layer. Sometimes the hot, warm, hot packs are great. I would highly recommend covering that with some sort of towel or like a fleece piece or a t-shirt, because that will get very hot, like too hot for the baby, or putting it underneath like a cardboard box or something that has the lid open so that mom can come in and get the baby if she's above at the top of the tree. She will eventually come looking for it, and typically that'll take a couple of hours. At that age, as long as there's heat support, a couple of hours is a good measure, 2 to 4 hours, I would say. Usually we can say as long as they're kept warm and they're not at risk to dying of hypothermia, then you can wait longer until nighttime, basically, so till dusk. But you never want to leave squirrels, at least gray squirrels, out overnight, because then they're at risk to predation and they're not usually active at nighttime. So that's the one that we want to talk about right now. Otherwise, baby owls, as they are falling from their trees, be aware that in your backyards, they might be either beginning to fledge, or they might be newborns that are unable to get themselves back up into their tree or their nest. I think in any situation, taking a photo of the area, the bird itself, and even like the tree it came from, if you step back really far so you can get an idea of what the distance is, that's really great for our team of arborist volunteers to know, so that they can say, okay, what kind of tree is it? What are the risks if we were to climb this tree and use climbing equipment? Is it too tall, or is it short enough that we can reach the nest with a tall ladder? So all of those things can really help the understanding and the situation. And then also monitoring to see if you notice adult activity. I think sometimes it's a little easier to see an adult owl in a tree who might be eyeing you from above and really, really mad that you're approaching its baby on the ground, aside from a squirrel who might be in a nest feeding its babies, and it takes a while until she's like, oh, I only have 4 of my 5 babies. Okay, I gotta go find the one that's missing. Usually great horns are pretty tight in their territory during the breeding season, and so usually you'll see one or both parents around, at least trying to protect the nest and the babies. Dad is out hunting most of the time. Mom is usually with the nest and the babies. So if a baby falls to the ground, and let's say it is a baby great horned owl, what we're looking for are the tiny, fluffy, grapefruit-sized, white-feathered fluff balls. Those are nestlings. They are too young to be out of the nest, If they are old enough to be out of the nest, they're able to walk on their feet, they're able to spread their wings in defense, and they are trying to actually learn how to do some moving, maneuvering, and hunting even on the ground. So that's a little later into the season. Typically in the month of March or so, we're seeing more nestlings than we are seeing fledglings. So those are birds that if they can't truly walk or move around or climb the tree again on their own, they're going to sit at the base of the tree waiting for mom to drop them food potentially. And it's hit or miss whether or not mom will be able to help in that situation. And also great horned owls is an example, and a lot of your other owl species have something that is different than others, like our waterfowl species, where they have a full clutch that hatches at the same time. Our owls are usually going to do this in sequence, where the first baby is brooded on and hatches, and then a couple days later you get the next one. And so each of the babies is actually a little bit different age than the one next to it. There's some sibling rivalry. So if mom has accidentally lost the youngest or the oldest baby out of the nest, then she'll prioritize maybe feeding and caring for the one that's still in the nest, sometimes ignoring the one on the ground. Not always, but it's something to be aware of. So if it is a hatchling, like truly a hatchling great horned owl that falls from the nest down to the ground, we do risk fracturing feet or legs or pelvises. So we do see a good number of broken bones. So typically those are the ones we're going to likely suggest come in to rehabilitation for an evaluation. And usually we like to clear all of our owls from any injuries before we send them back up with an arborist to help put them back in the nest with their parent. And since it's baby season, the one thing I want to pass along to everyone is that mom is always going to be the best thing for her babies. Bringing an animal into a wildlife rehabilitator, while great in concept, is actually a lower chance of success than if they left in the wild with their parents, because we are not the same as them. So we want to make every effort to put any healthy animals back with the care of their parents, because it's a more natural upbringing and it's better for their mental, psychological, and behavioral health and everything else supporting them moving forward into the wild and into the world. So let us know if you have any questions or if you find other species. Today we've been talking about our little neonate eastern gray squirrels that are just coming about, and then we've also got our great horned owl hatchlings that are just about to get here. So definitely give us a call if you have any questions or a photo you want to send us just to verify. Our number is 608-287-3235. And we also have a photo text line that you can find on our website. So thanks for listening here on WORT about baby sazing. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Aisha Malik.
Rowena Kermeens was your reporter.
Special thanks to feature contributors Pete Harden, Bert Zipperer, Emily Tucker, and Jackie Sandberg.
Super Dave Lawrenson engineered the show.
Bay Parks produced this newscast.
Jolly Pittman is the news director at WORT, and I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. You know what to do. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And I'm your host, Christian Knutson. Stay up. Up next is Spanish Language News with Nuestro Patio. Good night.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bluestem Jazz, presenting Twin Talk at the North Street Cabaret on Friday, March 21st at 8 p.m. Chicago's Twin Talk, featuring saxophonist Dustin Lorenzi, bassist singer Katie Ernst, and drummer Andrew Green, create a style that is elastic, spontaneous, and open. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org.
Support for this program is provided by WORT's listener sponsors and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2304. Local 2304 is a small local union with a big agenda, bringing power to the people by representing the workers who provide safe and reliable gas and electric service at MG&E. The professional union reps at Madison Teachers Incorporated and the staff collective right here at WORT. More information about the union is available on their website at ibew2304.com.
And at 7 o'clock, you're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison. Coming up next, in Nuestro Patio.
Bienvenido a Nuestro Patio, un espacio en Word para la comunidad latina.
¡Panamá!
¡Presente!
¡Puerto Rico!
¡Presente!
¡México!
¡Presente!
¡Venezuela!
¡Presente!
¡Perú!
¡Presente!
¡República Dominicana!
¡Presente!
¡Cuba!
¡Presente!
¡Costa Rica!
¡Presente!
¡Colombia!
¡Presente!
¡Honduras!
¡Presente!
¡Ecuador!
¡Presente!
Hola, hola, muy buenas tardes y bienvenidos a una edición más de Nuestro Patio, el programa en español de WORT 89.9 FM, la radio comunitaria. Hoy, martes 11 de marzo del 2025, segundo martes de marzo. De hecho, antes que nada, queremos agradecerle muchísimo a las personas que ayudaron a WORT en esta recaudación de fondos. Llegamos a nuestra meta. Gracias a ustedes, gracias a la gente que nos escucha, que llama, que hace un poquito de ruido para que sus amigos también, sus amigas también donen a la estación. Entonces, muchísimas gracias porque llegamos a nuestra meta. Si por alguna razón ustedes querían donar, pero estaban esperando que llegara la quincena, muchísimas de estas cosas, tenemos una